Okay. Is everybody back?
Yep.
Okay, good. Okay, so we'll start if there are any announcements. Well, one thing that I did want to remind everybody of is we have the Climate Literacy AGU sessions, and some of you on the phone are conveners of those sessions. I've started to send out emails today reminding people that they're kind of due in a week. Just for your context, because tomorrow, next week is Passover, after the end of this week, you won't hear from me next week. In fact, Scott, I'm going to ask, can you facilitate the call next week?
I think so.
Next Tuesday?
Yeah, I think so.
That's good. So just a reminder, because we need to get those session proposals in. And so it sounds like we're going to have 11 sessions proposed. And so we'll see how that plays out. The other thing that has happened, as I started to talk about more in a more social kind of mode before, was the NSTA meeting, which was held last week in Boston, along with the Council of State Science Supervisors meeting, which was the first 3 days of the week, and the NSTA meeting was the last 3 days of the week. There was an overlap on Wednesday. Was anybody else who was on the call also at the meeting?
Hi there, Tamara.
Hi, so Frank, I heard you, and then
was
who
that
else?
Frank? This is Jane Heinz-Fry. Hi, you guys.
Oh, Jane. Hi.
And Kristen's here, too. I wasn't at the National Council Science Supervisors, but I was at NSCA. Yep.
Okay, so I can give my perspectives, but I'd like to have everybody else's. I mean, everybody, this was such a big meeting. We didn't really see each other very often, so we have lots of perspectives. So. Why don't we have Jane? How about you? What was your perspective on the meeting? What did you think was interesting or new or interesting that might be of interest to this group?
Okay, so I think I had shared with everybody before that if you browsed for climate change when you were searching the number of presentations, 45 of them actually had climate change in their titles, and I think it was Frank who pointed out that a lot of the other sessions may have addressed climate change but not had it in their titles. So I would say that there was a considerable amount of exposure to climate change at the national conference. That's number one. They also had James Balog as one of their, so he's the Chasing Ice Guy, and they had him as one of the keynote speakers. So I think that was big. There were a lot of different types of presentations, so some of them were more sort of PowerPoint-oriented. There was one that was a casual lunch chat, and golly, that was fun because you actually got to see ice cores and see the drill bit kind of thing and chat with people who do that kind of research, so that was interesting. So I think what we can say was there's a wide representation there. I did have my little sign-up table, and I do have 8 people who signed up to help with Mark McCaffrey's spearheading of producing a resource that would help teachers translate the National Climate Assessment to something useful to teachers. 6 of those were from the New England area, but I do have one from Texas and one from the Midwest that I'll try to summarize that information. And I'll send it on to you, to Tamara, to you, and to Mark, and maybe we can pull those people in to help us. Okay?
Okay, great.
Very good.
Okay, how about Kristen?
Well, this is my first NSTA, so I was a little overwhelmed. I didn't realize it was so big. I was at the Share-a-thon. That was really nice pretty intense hour of doing some good networking with educators that were really specifically interested in the work we do. So I really appreciated being a part of that. I was there working a lot with the Next Generation Science Standards curator group, and so I did a lot of work with them while I was there, so I didn't make it to as many sessions as I would have liked. But as far as that group of the work that we're doing with that group, it was really interesting to have met them all 6 months ago when we were all kind of starting to figure out what these standards were all about, and come back and having received some professional development the last couple of months too. I think we're feeling like we're all in a place where we really understand this three-dimensional piece and how it works and resources and how they align with those. So that was good. I was really impressed with the climate steward session that Bruce and you guys all, some of you put together. I thought that it was pretty packed when I was able to make it in there, and really good speakers and good information coming out of that. I hope that's something that happens again, because I thought that was really great, really well done. And so that's some of my reflections. It was nice seeing some of you. It was big, so I didn't have a chance to run into folks as much.
Yeah. Okay, Frank?
Sure. So I'm building on what was said already. I think one of the key things that, given the extent of work, and when I was in the Share-a-thon with Kristen, you're looking around the room, and this was the NESTA Earth Weather, Climate Share-a-thon, and the Clean Network was very well represented. I mean, when Turk next to Don Dugenhaus, and then up with Lynn Cherry, you could see our network is a very large representation of the body of work that's going on at NCA and other events. And it felt really good to know that we have a body to do that coordination between these events. But I think the most telling, exploration was, from my perspective, at the Council of State Supervisors, the thinking about how the standards are going to be implemented in the states. But then also a key thing that maybe not everyone's catching is that something that Ted Willard, a member of our network, shared in one of our side meetings, was that every single state standards that have come out, whether they adapted, or pretty much did their own thing, used the NRC framework as the foundation for those standards. Whether they omitted some, like maybe Oklahoma did when they released theirs, but they're still very much in the body of work. So the work that Scott Harley and I did, and others in the community, where we looked at alignments of where is climate literacy in the NGSS, I don't think they used our systems to omit, because there was probably a lot more that they should have cut out than they did. And so we still have a strong foothold in a very large portion of the nation's education systems. How that implies for teaching and resources, well, that's the work for us for the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And I'll reflect on that. At the Council of State Science Supervisors meeting, there was a lot of discussion around how to implement them. So, last year I was at the Council of State Science Supervisors meeting when the standards were released. And there's been a lot of thinking that's gone on over the course of the year, and it was interesting also to see the political logistics that the supervisors have to go through, not just to sort of think about the logistics of in the classroom and with the teachers, but the politics of it is huge also. So is there anybody, I don't want to spend a whole lot more time on this because we do have a presentation today, but was there anybody else on the call who was at the meeting? Okay, well, with that, I think that we will go on to our presentation today. Today we have Dana Brown-Hein from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's Institute for Environment, where she is a program director for UNC's Climate Leadership and Energy Awareness Program, the Climate LEAP Program, and for North Carolina's Climate Fellows Program, which is a teacher professional development program funded by the NASA NICE Award. So the slides are available on the website, so I hope people were able to download them. And with that, I will turn it over to Dana, who will talk about empowering pre-college students to engage in climate change solutions.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yep.
Yes, we can.
Okay. Good. Well, so I recognize many names on the call, and I've gotten to know some of you through my work with the NASA Teacher Professional Development Program that I run, but I do wear another hat where I do some science enrichment for high school students, and so that's what I'm here to talk to you about today. The Climate Leadership and Energy Awareness Program is a program that I was the lead author on writing the grant, and I'm the PI for and the program director for the program, so it's really been kind of my baby. We wrote the grant in 2008 and got funding for this program in 2009. We did have a gap year last year where we did not have funding to run the program, but we're starting up with our fifth year of the program, which will start this summer. So the presentation that I'm giving today is really kind of adapted from one that I gave at GSA in Charlotte several years ago. I feel like I'm biased, of course, since this is my program, but I feel like I found a program that really does work to empower high school students to engage in climate change solutions. So I'll tell you what our approach is and also share with you just what the program is all about and also how we evaluate it and how we're hopefully going to increase the rigor of our evaluation during our second funding cycle. So moving to slide 2, I just want to acknowledge the funders. The main funder for the program is the Burroughs Welcome Fund, which is housed here in Research Triangle Park, so it's a private foundation. Their interest is in funding summer or student science enrichment programs that are extracurricular. So most of their programs have a summer component or an after-school component. I'm with the UNC Institute for the Environment, so they, of course, support the program. Also, we've partnered with the UNC Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center. And the Alliance for Climate Education has also been a partner in more recent years, and we're hoping to move forward with that partnership during our next funding cycle. And we also work in partnership with the Department of Physics and Astronomy here at UNC. So there are a lot of players in making this program successful. The overarching program goals were really dictated by our funder. So these are the big goals that kind of direct our program. Our program, we need to show that we're improving students' competence in science. And with the Climate Leadership and Energy Awareness Program, we're focusing on climate literacy and energy literacy. We also strive to nurture their enthusiasm for science and foster student interest in science-related careers. The funder is also particularly interested in engaging females and minorities underrepresented in science careers. So, this program attracts rising 9th through 12th graders that are local to the university. So we draw from two counties around the university. Typically, our program serves about two-thirds female students, and about one-third of those are minority, underrepresented in the sciences. Slide 4, this outlines the program components of the Climate Leap program, and please stop me if you have any questions. The students come to the campus of UNC Chapel Hill for a week-long summer institute. It's a non-residential summer institute. So they get 5 days of, lots of a mixture of different activities. I'll talk more about that in a minute. This year, we are going to have 7 academic year activities. We'll maintain contact with these students throughout the academic year, and this will allow us to extend program content. In our last round of the program, we only had 4 Saturday academies. We found that some students weren't able to come to Saturday academies for various reasons. So this year we're adding in 3 teacher workday excursions where we will basically take field trips and do other things with the students when they're out of school for teacher workdays. And then another aspect to the program is that we ask each student to lead a community outreach project. And that can really vary in what it looks like, but we just ask the student to communicate about something climate, energy, or sustainability related, to another audience. It could be verbal, in writing, there's a whole bunch of different things they could do for that, and I'll talk more about that later as well. All these pictures throughout the presentation are from the program. These are students here learning. They're actually making biodiesel at a local biodiesel cooperative, and then they're learning about composting. And just to orient you to where we are, in North Carolina, Chapel Hill, kind of in the center of the state next to Durham and Raleigh, there you can see the blue triangle is about where we are. We do have something great about our location is we have a lot of proximity to research and industries related to the topics that we cover in Climate Leap. So we have UNC Chapel Hill, Duke University, and North Carolina State University nearby to pull from in terms of guest speakers and field trips. We also have the Research Triangle Park, where EPA is housed, also the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, and a Research Triangle Institute, and then over 500 clean tech industries in the area. So we felt like this is a great area to launch this type of program devoted to climate and energy. So when I first started writing the grant for this program, I wanted to do climate change education to students, but I didn't just want the program to be about climate change. I didn't feel like that was going to be enough. So I decided to kind of couch my program using a story of energy and really letting energy providing a seed of hope to students. And I really like this quote from the publisher of Orion: "We need a way of exploring environmental issues that is realistic and honest, yet hopeful and inspirational." So my goal was to, you know, create program content, given that it's at the high school level, was going to be scientifically rigorous, but was going to also provide students with hope that it's not all gloom and doom. So that's what I'm going to weave throughout my presentation today. So some things that we are doing to empower students to engage in climate change solutions. Really, we want the program to not just be where they learn about climate change and energy, but we want them to actually go out and be leaders in their communities, leaders in their schools and their neighborhoods and their churches and their scout troops, and really start, you know, taking ownership and being responsible for their actions. These are three kind of big things that we do to try to empower the students to become climate leaders. We use an energy story to frame climate change as a symptom of society's use of fossil fuels. We feature scientists and engineers throughout the program who are working to develop solutions to move us to a lower carbon economy. We're letting them actually meet people and see the labs where some of this innovative research is happening. And we provide the students opportunities to develop their science communication and leadership skills. So really, all along, the Climate Leap program has been telling a story. And I recently learned about Randy Olson's "And But Therefore" template for storytelling. And that's really what we already have been doing with Climate Leap. I've put it here in this template. But really, we start out the week-long institute talking about the fundamentals of energy and how society is using fossil fuels to power it. So I say here, we are burning fossil fuels and contributing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. But, and the but is where the story gets exciting, right? But this is contributing to climate change. So then we lead into the programming by talking about what are the consequences of these carbon emissions. We focus on energy a lot, but we don't exclude other things that are contributing to climate change, like deforestation and other land use changes and agriculture. And then the therefore piece, the so, that's kind of the synthesis piece. We must find ways to decrease our CO2 emissions. And this leads into the second half of the week being devoted to solutions. So we talk about sustainability and what that means. We talk about energy conservation, efficiency. We talk about nuclear energy, renewable energy, and we also talk about civic engagement and how students can get involved and interact with their local policymakers. I feel like this strategy works really well to put climate change science in the context of this larger energy story. It's also something that the Earth, the Operator's Manual film series does very well, so I've used that with students as well. Moving on to slide 9, this is just a kind of a visual of how we run the program. So the 5-day Summer Institute, we have 1 day devoted to energy basics. We cover a lot of the things that are in the energy literacy framework in terms of just energy fundamentals. We tour a coal-fired power plant here on campus. Then we move into looking at climate science. We talk about the greenhouse effect. How do we know that that humans are contributing to climate change. We have a climate scientist come in and talk about that. Then we move into impact. So what are impacts to human health? What are impacts to ecosystems? What are impacts to the oceans? We spend a day on impacts. And then the last 2 days of the Institute are focused on these solutions, giving students really the hope that people are working to solve these problems, but that they also can be part of the solution as well. Our academic year activities, these are going to be Saturday academies or teacher workday events. This year we're going to have one focused on climate change and human health, where we'll go tour the EPA and NIEHS. We're going to have one devoted to sustainability and civic engagement, where they meet with policymakers. We do one on green buildings and sustainable design. Also solid waste and climate change. So we look at the impact of, you know, landfills and methane and recycling, and just what's the connection there. So we get them touring those facilities and learning about how solid waste contributes to climate change and how we can improve how we handle solid waste. We'll do a Saturday Academy on nuclear energy, because where there's a nuclear power plant nearby we can visit. And then we also have some leadership training events in collaboration with the Alliance for Climate Education. We weave leadership activities really into all of our academic year events. Are there any questions so far? Like, I'm talking fast.
How many years have you run this so far?
So we ran three. So we, for the first 3 years of the program, we did 2 weeks per summer, so it's 48 students for each summer. The fourth year of the program, we had less funding, so we only ran 1 week. And then we had a gap year, and so we're starting up with our fifth year this summer, and we have funding to run it for 3 more years. So we'll have, I guess,
so
7 years under our belt.
Is this another NASA grant, or how did you get the additional funding?
It's the private foundation, the Burroughs Wellcome Fund, and then we're gonna look to maybe institutionalize the program somehow, so that we don't have to keep looking for external funding. Right now, the program is free to students, and they actually get a stipend for participating. So it could also be that down the road, if we want to keep the program running, we might have to have some sort of revenue being generated through a camp fee. So we're exploring options to make this program sustainable beyond this next round of funding. And I think we're going to...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that you found a way to sustain the effort in looking for how to institutionalize it. I'd be interested in hearing how that proceeds over time.
I know. Yeah, we are too. You know, it's hard with... I think finding funding to do energy-related outreach is easier, especially in our state of North Carolina. Climate now is, a hot word here, climate change. So that limits, I think, partially who's going to fund our program. But hopefully we'll be able to not have to worry about grant funds in the future. So the program is free, and I think that really does help us get a diverse applicant pool. And students from all different kind of walks of life.
This is Frank Maple. Another question. In your time with the students, how much time do they talk about the wind and solar role in this space?
The wind and solar what?
The role, meaning that wind and solar, some of the research NOAA is finding in preliminary results is wind and solar are already competitive with fossil fuels and could reach something in the order of 80% of our energy demand.
Right. Yeah, well, so we definitely spend time on wind and solar, in part because they lend themselves to ideal hands-on activities. We spend probably about 3 hours, well, actually probably 4 hours talking about solar energy, and not just talking about it, but they make... dye sensitized solar cells with blackberry juice, and they compare those to silicon-based photovoltaic cells, and they take those out and see how to maximize power output. They also tour, there are some solar energy facilities here on campus through a Department of Energy grant, Energy Frontier Research Center. So they meet with scientists who are trying to improve the efficiency of photovoltaic cells and make them cheaper, you know, more affordable for people. So they learned some of that science as well. And then with wind energy, you know, North Carolina has a lot of offshore wind potential, also some mountaintop wind potential. So we do, definitely relevant to our state. And we have them build wind turbines, and they kind of compete with each other to see who can maximize their power output. So, and then we also, of course, talk about the pros and cons of wind and solar. We talk about the pros and cons of every energy source, both renewable and non-renewable. We also talk about the social implications of each one. So they kind of, they get a big picture, and they learn that there's no one, you know, energy, you know, there's no one magic bullet that it's going to take a portfolio of energy sources to power our planet. So we do, if you want to move to slide 10, we do engage students in many hands-on activities. I try as best I can to limit lectures. So we really try to do activities, tours, demonstrations. We do have some lecture, but we try our hardest to keep lectures from happening because the students just don't respond as well to it. But we do bring in, each year we expose the students to about 20 or so different scientists. And that leads into slide 11, which is we do bring in many different scientists and graduate students to contribute to programming. They give presentations. They might conduct lab activities with the students. Also lab tours, they'll show the students their labs and talk about their research, and then field trips. So we might go to a field trip. One thing we are also fortunate to be near are some experimental plots in Duke Forest, which is a forest devoted to research. There are some global warming plots here outdoors that we take the students to, and they meet the scientists doing, you know, actual research in the field. So that's really neat as well. And we try to show them that all these scientists are people and that they have personalities, and we try to expose them to young to old scientists and all different colors of scientists. And it's we want all of them to see that they could be scientists. So that's definitely an underlying theme. Slide 12, something we also do is we invite students who successfully complete the program to come back the following year and serve as a peer mentor. And so we give them opportunities to take on leadership roles and teaching roles during the Summer Institute or the academic year activities. So these are pictures of some of our peer mentors assisting with hands-on activities. Slide 13 is just a little bit of data from the first 3 years of our program. These were our fully funded years. We had 126 or 88% of students complete the program. Of those students, 86 of them completed at least one community outreach project. And these projects varied from making brochures on fuel-efficient driving habits to writing a letter to the editor in the local paper to crafting a public service announcement on a local radio station. It really varied. We really weren't picky about what the student did as long as they were communicating in one form or another to a different group. A lot of them do choose to conduct outreach projects that are related to energy and sustainability. And I'd love to see more related to climate change. 43 of them participated in a leadership training that ACE conducted. And we're going to be building on that component in our second funding cycle. And then 28 of them were selected to serve as Climate Leap peer mentors. So we're excited that the students want to come back and be peer mentors. And I think 6 of them actually served as a peer mentor for 2 years. And this year we're going to open it up to having undergraduates be peer mentors as well, which I think will also really help our program. Slide 14 is something I'm going to be looking at more in the second funding cycle, is how well is the program inspiring behavior change. One alumni survey we did, 28 students responded to it, which is a smaller in value than I would like, but of those 28, 89% said they were motivated by the program to make at least one behavior change to conserve energy and resources in their daily life. So we're going to be working harder during the second cycle to capture those behavior changes. I'm looking at, making my own kind of instrument, using maybe pulling some things from the Six American Survey, some other tools I've learned about, you know, through my time at AGU and GSA, and trying to put something together to really see the impact that we're having on students. But I'm pleased with the initial data, and also I hear a lot from parents about what their kid got out of the program, and so just trying to capture that more too is important to me during the second cycle. And then I just thought I'd share with you some of our data and kind of how we're evaluating our program. Our funder is interested in us showing that students are learning something. The challenge there is that we're in, it's an informal learning environment. It's a summer camp, and we want the students to have fun and not feel like they're in school. So we've been trying to find ways to capture their learning that are not based on multiple choice tests or anything like that. One thing we do is we do give them a pre-survey prior to coming to the Summer Institute, and then we also give them a post-institute evaluation where they just self-report on their knowledge. And the students do feel that they are learning during the institute, as you can see from slide 15 here. Again, this isn't, we would want more than this to show that they're learning, but we are pleased in knowing that the students feel like they are gaining knowledge in respect to climate change and the various solutions that exist to address climate change, and also their knowledge of what are the all available alternative energy sources. Some other things we've tried in order to assess learning, we've tried concept mapping, where we had students do pre and post concept maps. This is slide 16. And this is a pre and post map from the same student. And what we did, this was pretty time consuming, and we didn't do this beyond, I think, the second year. But we tried to quantify the differences between these maps. And we did see a difference, but it was really time consuming to score these. And we just felt like we wanted to do something different. We didn't do any type of rigorous evaluation, and we didn't publish on this or anything. I certainly could probably go back and do that. But you can see here, and some of you are already familiar with concept maps, that, you know, typically the concept maps were kind of more sophisticated, on the post maps were, you know, better, more terminology, maybe slightly higher level of thinking and all that. So we're able to quantify that. But once we did that, then I wanted to kind of do something else. And that led me to my next ideas, slide 17. I actually got this idea from the clean collection, the power source activity, and I love it. I do this with students and teachers. But basically, I give them an electrical outlet there on the left, and I ask them to draw the behind the scenes, you know, where do they get their electricity from? So you can see the pre-drawing here, the student really doesn't have much to say or to draw. And then their post-drawing, so this is the same student, you can see how this is after this is after the Summer Institute. So just within that week-long Summer Institute, you can see how much their knowledge expands about where their energy comes from. So we have kind of quantified some of this data. You know, it turns out that with this particular cohort, only 38% of students could identify coal as an energy source at the beginning of our Summer Institute, and then at the end it was 75% put coal in their concept maps. Similar data for nuclear energy, for instance. So coal and nuclear are our two big energy sources here in North Carolina. So we'll probably continue doing this and do a more rigorous analysis of it in future years. That's my plan, trying to find a graduate student to help me. And then also something that we have done, and I've become really interested in the work of Ann Gold and Sarah Harris, for instance, is looking at drawings of the greenhouse effect, pre and post drawings. This is a sample student drawing. We spend a lot of time talking about the greenhouse effect, and they, of course, hear about it from a scientist, and I talk about it. One thing I do that we really like is I send them outside with Vernier probes. They have a CO2 sensor, infrared thermometers, and light sensors. And I just have worksheets for them, and I encourage them just to explore their environment. And basically, they're exploring the greenhouse effect without knowing it. So they're exploring where there is CO2 in the atmosphere. They're looking at the different colored surfaces and which surfaces have a higher surface temperature and how that correlates to the amount of light reflected, for instance. And then we come and we kind of synthesize all that as a class and go into more depth on the greenhouse effect. And then we ask them to do this post-drawing. The post-drawings aren't, I still would like to see them improved. And I'm going to be working this time on how to improve my instructions to get, hopefully, you know, a better assessment of what their knowledge is. And I'm really curious about, you know, learning from the work of Ann Gold and Sarah Harris, who also do this work, kind of work with undergraduates. It might be hard to see in the slide, but the pre-drawing here that this student has, you know, it's pretty simple. There's no mention of greenhouse gases, for instance. Many students have the sun in these drawings, and they have the Earth's atmosphere, but after that, it kind of, it really varies. But then you can hope, you might be able to read that in the post drawing here, the student, you know, did add greenhouse gases and kind of was able to be a little bit more specific about the radiation that contributes to the greenhouse effect. So we're hoping to do a more rigorous analysis of this assessment in future program years. So we'll keep this in the program for sure. And that's really all I had. I thought, you know, you guys would also have questions, but that's a big overview of the program. It's a lot of fun, and I also work with teachers around climate change, so it's been great to be able to bring my experiences with these high school students to also help teachers talk about climate and energy in their classrooms. So I think I covered the basics for the program, and I'm definitely open to questions. And I know others of you are doing very similar work.
Well, thank you, Ingrid. Are there any questions?
Yeah. This is Ingrid. It looks like a great program. And I was wondering, can you identify what are the characteristics or aspects of the program that you think are make it most successful?
Well, a couple things. I mean, I definitely think we try to really work a lot of hands-on activities into the program. And we also weave in, with the leadership component, we weave in group games. And we also do, I don't know if you've heard of the Systems Thinking Playbook. And there's also a Climate Systems Thinking Playbook. We weave in some games that are designed to help them think about how systems work. And so I think that's fun because we can try to convey some content, but also there are games that are fun for the students to play and interact with each other. So I think we build in an element of fun into the week, and it's definitely a challenge to balance science content with fun. But I think the leadership piece to the program has enabled us to do that because you can almost take any game and do a leadership debrief on it, for instance. And then I also think something successful about the program is the climate and energy piece, those pieces together. I have a colleague at EPA who does a climate change summer program, and she's even commented to me that her students just aren't even, they aren't as enthusiastic as she sees my students be. And I feel like maybe part of that is that energy piece really does provide that sense of hope and, you know, positive energy that things are happening and that there are people really trying to work on this. So that's, I do think that's a piece of the program that makes it successful is that energy piece. It gives students this tangible thing to hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
And then just, I think also the fact that this program is long-term and that we meet with them throughout the year, I think that helps too. So you build a community of students, and then the peer mentor aspect allows for kind of vertical leadership within each year, too.
Do your students take any of this back to school with them?
Yeah, I think some of them do. It's you know, what's challenging about high school students is they don't know, like, what you're interested in as the program director. So I hear more from parents than I do from the students. You know, I know that some students have said that the content has helped them, say, in AP Environmental Science, or they might pursue an environmental science course when previously they weren't planning to take one. And so we have some data that gets to that kind of enthusiasm for science and where they take that enthusiasm, whether it's in the science classroom or if it's more extracurricular into environmental clubs. We have had some students start environmental clubs at their school or recycling programs. And so we are trying to capture that as best we can. But parents have been a really key audience for capturing that information just because the students sometimes themselves don't seem to know what's important to us from a reporting standpoint, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, so we do a parent survey each year, an online parent survey, to try to capture some of that.
That's
Hi,
great.
Dana.
Uh-huh.
Dana, this is Jane, and I wanted to thank you for giving us this very fabulous presentation.
Thank you.
I'm especially looking because it's an area that I spend a lot of time on the pre- and post-concept mapping piece.
Uh-huh.
And I'm interested that you also did the pre- and post-drawings. I appreciate
yes.
how you're trying to pursue this evaluation piece that
mm-hmm.
goes in a different place from the traditional multiple choice type questions. Thank you
yeah.
for all of your efforts along those lines. And
yeah.
I'm wondering if you, was the pre-post concept map made by the same person? I believe it was.
Yes.
But I'm not sure. Did you get
yeah.
them back their original one to work from and ask how they wanted to change it, or did you have them make it from scratch again?
We had them make them from scratch.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
And I
wondered for you evaluating it, did you have any software that you could use help evaluate it, and would that be helpful to you if you had something like that? I might be able to find something that may assist you, is what I was thinking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, we did not use software. We just used people, and we used maps. You know, we didn't know if we were evaluating a pre- or a post-map. So we went through, and we made a rubric, and we used the rubric
yep.
to score the maps, and then we came together and did averages. So we tried to do it as best we could. But, it was time-consuming. And a software program
would be
great.
Very time-consuming.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. I'll see what I can get my hands on because I know many people have struggled with that issue.
Yeah.
And
yes.
if I can find something that would help you investigate that further and see if it's helpful, I'd be glad to do that. So
yeah,
I'll
that
try
would
to
be great.
You something. And I think
yeah,
your email...
Mhm. It's on the final slide.
Terrific. Thank you.
Mhm. Yeah, and we with teachers, I've also done concept mapping. And I presented on that at the AGU meeting in a poster, and that with teachers, what we did do is we gave them their original concept maps back, and we had them refine them, and they had their vocabulary terms written on post-it notes. So the nice thing about
right.
that is they were able to move things around and take some off and add new ones, and I took pictures of the before and after, and we did some quantitative analysis there, fairly simple, where we would just count new terms and look at the connections. Again, that wasn't as rigorous either because just the time to do it is just a lot, and sometimes the funders don't want, maybe they would love to see that, but your funding doesn't hinge on this great evaluation. Future funding does, and it'd be great to publish too at some point.
One of the things that we've done in one of our projects is that in addition to the concept map or whatever you have the students do, we also
mm-hmm.
have somebody who we can consider an expert so that you can
yes.
not only compare to the pre and post, but what is it that you're aiming for and how close are you getting them? Now, obviously, with younger students, you're not going to get them to the expert, but you could potentially have maybe seniors who are in environmental science or involved with, you know, whatever their degrees are in that have the energy focus to potentially do that, so you can sort of see how, you know, how you're getting the students to approach what might be considered a good level of understanding.
Yeah, and I think that's something I've really gotten from learning about the work of Ann Gold and Sarah Harris, is they're trying to figure out, or they're also thinking about, what is it we do want students to know about the greenhouse effect? So, you know, what level of detail, you know, is enough or sufficient for high school students, say. So that's something that I'm kind of grappling with, is, you know, what do I want them to have on their maps, and then go from there to score it accordingly. So I'm definitely learning a lot from their work in terms of how to do it differently next time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think having experts, and yeah, that's a good idea to even think about, you know, undergraduate students and how they're doing maps.
Okay, are there any other questions for Dana?
Well, thank you. Thanks for letting me have this opportunity to share the program with you.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate it. Next month, we will have the National Climate Assessment Education Affiliate Group conversation. And so we will talk to you then.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks everyone.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you so much, Dana. That was really great.
Thank you. Thanks.
Great program.